Hi, everyone. I have something to tell you, and I don't really know how to say it, so I'm just going to say it like it is. I have decided to end my time as part of the marketing team at Beyond Booksmart, and sadly, that means that I will no longer be hosting Focus Forward. Today's episode is not our last, though. We are going to be dropping one more at the beginning of February, so I hope you come back to listen to that. I don't know what the future is for the show, but I'm sure if Beyond Booksmart decides to keep it going, they will continue to provide great content for you guys. I won't say too much about our last episode, but it'll be special, and I do hope you come back to listen to that. And the archive of the old episodes will still be available, so you can always go back and listen there. The podcast has been such an important part of my life for the past 4 years, and I'm so grateful for that. So grateful for the listeners, for my guests, everything. And this was definitely not an easy decision to make, but I'm really excited to see what the future holds for me. So if you want to keep up with me, I would love to stay in touch. You can find me on LinkedIn or Instagram, and I would really love to hear from you. And I'll also still be doing some coaching for Beyond Booksmart, so you could also just email me there at hchoy@beyondbooksmart.com. All right, so let's talk about today's episode, which is about dyslexia. I'm super excited to share this conversation with you. It was really great. I was joined by Ben Powers and Jeff Ruggiero from the Southport School here in Connecticut. We had the opportunity to record this interview in person at the Fairfield Public Library. Huge thank you to Philip Barr once again for letting us use his space and equipment and for helping us get everything set up. Recording in person is always such a treat. It's so much fun, and it really just brings a different kind of energy to the conversation, at least in my experience, it does. Since this is the first Focus Forward episode on dyslexia, we're really focused on the basics. Ben and Jeff help break down what dyslexia actually is, when what it's not, and why it's so much more complex than just reversing letters or struggling to read. We talk about the early signs of dyslexia, super important to look out for, the importance of early identification and screening, and what happens in the brain when a child is learning to read. We also spend some time talking about the overlap between dyslexia, ADHD, and executive function skills, and why so many students who struggle with reading also struggle with things like organization, working memory, task initiation, self-regulation, and confidence. Ben and Jeff did a great job of explaining why instruction matters so much, including the role of structured literacy and the science of reading, and why certain approaches work better for dyslexic learners. Actually, they work better for all learners, as you'll hear. This conversation is packed with insights for parents, educators, and anybody who works with or supports students with learning differences. I know I learned a ton from Ben and Jeff. They both brought deep expertise and a very human perspective to this topic. I just found myself learning and nodding and thumbs upping all the time. It was such a great conversation, and I really hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Let's get on with the show. Hello, welcome to Focus Forward. Thank you for joining me. We are at the Fairfield Public Library today, which is super exciting. And I have two gentlemen here joining me from the Southport School, which is in my hometown of Fairfield, Connecticut. And we're just so glad to have you guys here. Thank you so much. You want to introduce yourselves?
Great. Well, thanks for having us today. We're really excited to be here. So my name is Ben Powers. I am the executive director of the Southport School and the Southport CoLab. I'm also president of the Dyslexia Foundation and director of the Haskins Global Literacy Hub at Yale and UConn. And really, my work focuses on connecting research and practice so that we can take what we understand from research and really find effective ways to share that with our students and our families.
Great. I love it. And you?
Good morning. My name is Jeff Ruggiero. I'm the Executive Director of Academics and Research at the Southport School and the Southport CoLab. I'm celebrating my 35th year at the Southport School, so I may have the world's most boring resume. But if you look beneath it, I do have that opportunity on a daily basis to really integrate some of that research into practice so we can help not only our teachers and our students, but also our families and some of those kiddos that don't have the privilege of attending our school.
That's great. So 35 years of making a difference, I'm sure.
I try every day.
Yeah, that's great. So Ben, can you tell us a little bit about the Southport School and the CoLab, just so that listeners can understand like where you guys are coming from?
Absolutely. So the Southport School really serve students in grades 2 through 8 who have a primary identification of dyslexia or a similar language-based learning difference or ADHD. And so our students are really focused on building their core skills with structured literacy, which we do using the Orton-Gillingham approach, executive function, and really helping them become a strategic lifelong learner. And so the Southport CoLab is an outgrowth of that work we've done at the school, and it's really taking what we know works best from research that we've used effectively in the school with our students and translating that to be able to help impact Tier 1 classroom educators. So we work in public schools around the country, as far away as Alaska, actually, where we coach, train, and support teachers with effective implementation science in the classroom.
That's really cool. Let's start with dyslexia. Can you tell me what it is and what it's not so we can kind of make sure everyone has like a baseline understanding of what we're talking about today?
Right. So dyslexia is really, it's complicated. In fact, the IDA, the International Dyslexia Association, just updated the most recent definition of dyslexia. And the reason it's complicated is because there's no simple test for dyslexia. It's not black and white. And the reason for that is because the brain really involves a lot of different processes to become an effective reader. So the brain has to build this reading circuit. And in a nutshell, somebody with dyslexia is having difficulty building that reading network. They're usually struggling with identifying things like the sounds in words, which is called phonology. They typically have trouble with spelling and with writing. And so somebody with dyslexia is really not able to access the printed word in a way that is commensurate with their ability. And so what we do to figure out dyslexia is we do a lot of testing, neuropsychological or psychoeducational evaluations, and it takes usually multiple days and a lot of hours and a lot of time to really tease apart each individual student's profile, their relative areas of strength, their relative areas of deficit, and looking for those markers with things like phonological processing or rapid automatized naming, their ability to retrieve known words and objects from memory, those types of things. But it's a pretty complicated process to actually diagnose somebody with dyslexia.
Mm. Yeah, and it goes so far beyond just, like people say, like, oh, they just think D's are B's and B's are D's. It's way beyond that, right?
Right. Yeah, and I think, too, that the new definition of dyslexia that the International Dyslexia Association created really follows that research, right? It does look beyond that, looks at early language skill development as well, looks at not only some of that work that Ben had mentioned, but those neurobiological factors as well, some of those environmental factors. It's really, I think, broadening that and looking at that there are students out there. This might be that gateway to helping kids get that diagnosis, which can lead to that proper treatment earlier. Mm-hmm. And what we know about that early identification, which leads to early intervention, is we increase our chances of positive outcomes for these kids.
Mm-hmm. And so how early might signs of dyslexia show up? And what would that look like in a young child?
We've been working with Dr. Nadine Gabb using a screener called the Early Bird Reading Screener. And she's put quite a bit of research into that, which helps us identify some of those early reading vulnerabilities in children, even in the pre-K. The screener is designed to work with kids as early as that pre-K 4 year. So really getting a sense of, okay, where are the challenges, but where also are the strengths? And starting to look at that, and absent a diagnosis, if we see this area that's a pillar to reading development, if we catch that early on, absent of a diagnosis, we can still provide the right evidence-based approach or intervention to correct that earlier on, mm-hmm. then we're off to a better start and hopefully preventing some of these reading challenges later on.
For Would you say that it's usually, and maybe it doesn't matter, but would you say it's usually teachers that recognize these things or parents or maybe a combo?
I think it's a combination. Mm-hmm. I do think the work that we do with teachers is crucial.
Yeah.
We have committed to not only these early bird reading screenings for the community, for parents, but also for schools. We do a lot of outreach and working with teachers, but also with parents. Parents who may have a family history of dyslexia start to see these things, make those, it's almost impossible, right, as a parent, if you have more than one child to compare.
Yeah.
And you just, something doesn't sit right. Mm-hmm. Yesterday I met with a mom who said, it's just mom's intuition. This is my fourth child.
Yeah.
I just don't see the same. So getting that information, getting those resources in front of them so we can at least start those conversations and give them that information that they can pass along to the folks that are working with their kids.
I think everyone that I've ever interviewed for the podcast that has talked about, looking for signs in their children, has always said, like, trust your intuition, trust your gut, because we do know our kids. We know them more than we even realize we know them, I think.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. It's not really anything you can necessarily put into words, just kind of this gut feeling. And it's worth it to ask, especially since we know research shows that early intervention does make a huge difference in outcomes.
That's right.
Outcomes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's interesting. Dyslexia is very much like a puzzle. And as Jeff mentioned, we know this is also genetic. And so one of the huge benefits over the last 40 years has been that more individuals who are now parents are aware if they were identified, mm-hmm. that they're on the lookout. But absent of that, yes, exactly right. It's all about intuition. And there are early signs that parents might see, things like difficulty with rhyming. Mm-hmm. That's oftentimes in preschool, we see children have a difficult time rhyming. Or with word retrieval, they can't identify that known object that they should be able to name very quickly. So there are certain indicators early on that parents might not understand what that means, but then when the child is in school and they're starting to struggle with the printed word, you can begin to put that puzzle together in a way where you can actually see the entire picture. Yeah. And one of the reasons we're so excited about working on early identification, and one of the reasons we do this early screening, is that the model has very much been a wait to fail model.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a model where you're not able to put that puzzle together until third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade.
Yeah.
And that's really challenging for the student's experience with academic growth, for the parent, for the family, and a lot of times for self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
And so as Jeff has flagged, you know, the more we can do earlier and actually just be really proactive with good evidence-based instruction, we can help ameliorate a lot of those challenges that students and their families will face.
Yeah, and so much of it that you said, self-esteem, so much of it has I see that so much in my coaching, like when kids don't understand how their brains work or don't understand why things are hard, it can so much feel like, oh, this is just a personal failing of mine or a character flaw. And then that really, really, I mean, digs on your, you know, on your self-esteem, your confidence. So yeah, how wonderful to be able to catch that early. And that education and knowledge around it really does make such a big difference. Like just speaking about ADHD, I was diagnosed as an adult, which helped me then identify ADHD in my son. And I just didn't know about it enough. But if I look back to when he was little, like, oh, well, yeah. I mean,
it all makes sense.
Yeah, a lot of it that was really explained by that. But I just didn't know. And so that's
why would you?
Right. Why would I? Right. Yeah. Why would I? Yeah. So.
And I think, too, when you look at it and look at what you're doing and the success you're having, and I think as a parent, what's challenging of an ADHD son myself, who's now 24 years old, I think we fall into that trap sometimes, whether it's ADHD or dyslexia, and we start to characterize our child as a collection of their challenges.
Mm.
You know, and we could think about it in a different way and characterize them as a collection of what are those strengths that the ADHD brain has or the dyslexic brain has, and how can we tailor our instruction and tailor their learning and help them develop those habits that feed their strengths to overcome their challenges.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the core impetus of our work with executive function, right? We know their life skills, right? We know that we use them. We all use them day to day. We have to rely on them. It's helping our kids understand them, then start to identify when they're using them, which ones are their strengths, and how can I use some of those strengths to overcome some of those that are hard for me? What are some things that I can do if I have trouble getting started on a task? What works for me, what doesn't? So it becomes much more empowering. You know, if I have a hard time holding information and working memory, what can I do when someone's giving me instructions or I'm in a conversation? We're not even talking about school skills here.
Yeah.
We're talking about life skills.
Yeah.
Right? And then we can start to think about those school skills. Well, what can I do when I'm reading something? Right? What are some strategies I can use to help me hold some of that information? And I think it becomes empowering when we start to link those two. Well, I'm very good at planning and organizing, so maybe I can start developing reading plans, or maybe I can, when I'm planning my day, getting through my morning routine, that's going to help me from getting distracted. If I struggle with inhibition, that if I just have that plan and I follow it every day, every morning. So I think that those are some of the things that we tend to move away from as parents or adults when we look at children. Look at those strengths. How can we operationalize those strengths? How can we teach to those strengths?
And I imagine that if there are, that the implementation of the strategies that you use for your dyslexia are, it's easier to use them when you understand the executive function skills behind actually remembering to use them and understanding how your own brain works and which strategies are going to work the best.
Yeah,
so they really do work together.
Exactly. That was the first thing we did when we started our study on executive functions, really focused on, with our teachers, ourselves.
Yeah.
When do I use them, right? When we sit down and buckle down, right? And if we think about it, it's, you know, 4 o'clock on a Friday and you've got to hand something in before you leave at 5. What do? You put your phone aside.
Yeah.
Maybe you move somewhere else where you're not around your colleagues that want to talk because, hey, it's the end of the work week. I need to get this done. We do these things. You know, I can put things together without reading the manual. But then all of a sudden I bring home this thing from IKEA and I'm like, I'm lost. I had to buckle down and I have to follow the steps.
Yep.
And I have to monitor this task all the way through because this is outside my bail right now. So I think it's important to think about it that way. And when we introduce them to our kids and our teachers, the first thing we're doing is we're observing them in action outside the classroom.
Mm, yeah.
And then, okay, now let's see what happens in the learning environment. How do these kids make that shift from one class to the next or recess and lunch? How are they regulating their emotions throughout the day so those aren't getting the best of them and clogging that cognitive funnel, right? These are important things. And if we can bring it to the attention of our kids, show them that they have those metacognitive abilities to do it, and just provide that support and opportunities to practice it, talk about it, we can help them manage not only their daily life, but also their learning. Because whether it's an ADHD child or a dyslexic child, right, this is affecting how they're getting through their day.
Yeah. So I have a student who is a senior in college, and she has dyslexia and has been diagnosed with it for a long time. And she just this year decided to take advantage of the accommodations that the university provides. And she's saying, wow, I really should have, you know, taken advantage of this sooner. So what are some things that kids, both, you know, in the younger ages, or maybe just people, I suppose. Let's talk about some strategies that people of all ages, because dyslexia doesn't go away when you become an adult, can use to kind of get through their day, maybe some executive function skills that are helpful, but then also like practical strategies for dyslexia.
So I think one of the most important components of thinking about accommodations is that they need to be matched to the individual. I think a lot of times we hear an identification like dyslexia or executive function deficit, and we're primed to just give a list of things that we provide for a student that actually might not be helpful to them or actually might make their failure feel worse if they don't help. But there are some, you know, there are some really simple things that we can do. And, you know, I think most importantly, whether it's dyslexia or an executive function deficit, ADHD, it's really thinking about removing those limiting factors for them to access the information they need. So a specific example of that would be providing audiobooks for somebody who is really having difficulty with decoding. We don't want that gap of decoding to be a limiting factor for them to be able to digest text, to be able to learn about character development, to be able to learn about different genres. But not all individuals with dyslexia are going to enjoy an audiobook. In fact, some really don't like it. So it's really thinking about, when we look at their individual profile, what are their relative areas of strength? What are the relative areas of deficit? And how can we help them discover what are those accommodations that are going to work?
Yeah, I think that's a critical piece. If I could jump onto that and add to that, a lot of what we do with regards to accommodations are two things. One, they're top-down, as Ben's mentioning. And two, we have to be careful, too, that they're not lowering expectation. Right? That's not a real-world expectation. Right? No one's going to say, hey, I needed that report at 5, but, you know, you're ADHD. You could hand it in on Tuesday. Right? That's not going to happen. So it's making sure that even at the student level, that if we lower that expectation, what do we know about our kids, the ADHD kids, dyslexic kids? They're very perceptive. They're going to know that that accommodation is lowering the expectation. They're also going to know that that strategy, you know, this 5-point note-taking plan, they're going to know right away it doesn't work for them. So why not involve them in that process? And I always use the alarm clock analogy with parents. It's not the alarm clock that's going to necessarily, it's going to wake you up, because it's a loud noise potentially, but it's not going to get you out of bed. It works for some people. But if that doesn't work for you, let's work together to find a better way to get you up and out. If that wakes you up, great. What do we do next to make sure you've got the motivation, you've got the plan to get up and get your morning routine started? So I think it's critically important in our developmental approach to executive functions that as we're introducing these skills to our kids and they're identifying the ones that work for them, the strategies that are most effective are the ones that they develop with the teacher's help.
Absolutely.
Boy, that works for me.
Yep. Yeah, if you're gonna get their buy-in at all, they need to feel like they have some.
And we're the same way as adults, right? Any evaluation, performance evaluation in any walk of life, if it's a good evaluation, it highlights what the person is doing well. Because if we highlight what they're doing well, we're more often going to do that. We're going to continue to do that. Yeah. So we can show our kids what they do well. Now, how can I use some of that to work through some of the things that are more challenging for me?
And it's so, I have seen it be so hard for parents, especially because it's, you have your own perspective of what works for you and what has worked for you. And then you look at your child and maybe they appear, you know, like they're like lazy or they're, you know, just being defiant. And because what you want them to do is not working. But that's why it's so important to really involve them.
Yeah. Reframe that.
Yeah.
Reframe that through that executive function lens. Mm-hmm. Right, that laziness, that lack of motivation, that fatigue. What's the underlying cause?
Yeah.
Right? When you see that avoidance, I mean, I think that's such a critical piece of this. We know our students, and or as adults, we know we get anxious or we avoid things sometimes that are challenging. And so it's really trying to figure out, what are those stress points during the day? What do I see my child avoiding? What do I myself avoid? I can give you a really specific example to my own experience where when I started in this job at the Southport School, one of the most stressful things for me was meeting with the board chair. Mm-hmm. I would come out of those meetings. I cannot take notes and have a conversation at the same time. I have combined type ADHD. That is a huge challenge for me. I would come out of those meetings with these notes I could not decode. And I did it time and time again, and I would feel awful, and I would stress and be anxious and try to figure out what the heck was I supposed to do. And so, I'm so glad you gave this example of this student you're working with who's in college, who's finally advocating for herself to get those accommodations, because all we need to do is make small shifts in how we go about things. And in that case, all I did was come up with a strategy that at the end of the meeting, I asked the board chair to recap. Okay, can we just go and recap? What are all the things that we agreed to do today? Now, somebody shared that strategy with me. I didn't create it myself. But over time, I realized that worked, and that helped lessen the anxiety. And then I could walk out of that meeting feeling really confident about my next steps and knowing what to do. So it's really identifying those avoidant behaviors, those anxious moments, those stressors. And I think back to that gut instinct as a parent, I think we feel those through our children. We know there's something that's not going right for them. And so it's really helping unpack them in a way that doesn't shame, that doesn't come from a mindset of, oh, my child's being lazy. It's coming from a mindset of, how can I help you reach your full potential?
Yes, I agree. I always say, whenever we talk about that idea of, you know, your kid's not lazy, we're not lazy, I always say, like, I'll fight you till the end that you're not, because I do think you're absolutely right. It's coming from something else. It's not, I don't think we as humans don't want to be lazy. Yeah, sometimes you want to just lay around and do nothing, but that just feels good every once in a while.
And everyone wants to succeed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think about that, and I think back 35 years ago, the emphasis in special education was that behavior management, the token economy, assertive discipline, all these types of, because you can't, learning's not going to happen unless you have behavior managed in your classroom. I think what's evolved for me over the years is learning's not going to happen until you have optimal engagement.
Yeah.
That's right. Yes, you have to have behavior in place, but what also are you doing? What supports, what structures in your lesson design, your implementation, the course of your class or your school day, that's feeding those needs for those learners? You know, in looking at it, not only from a standpoint of, am I putting them in a position where they're being cognitively challenged, but also, am I creating those metacognitive pathways so that they can better process and get through our class, the school day? And am I looking at some of those, where do they need to inhibit? Where do they need to plan and organize? Where do they need to use their working memory? How am I supporting that in this lesson? How am I introducing that or priming our kids and saying, okay, before we start this, we're going to have a good plan. So work together as your groups to map out your plan. How are we fostering some of this learning management that they can take on so that they are optimally engaged and true learning can happen?
Yeah, and that engagement piece involves so much more than just what they're working on, right? It also involves their internal state and your internal state and how, you know,
absolutely.
How you are showing up in the classroom.
Right.
How the students slept last night,
right.
What they had for breakfast. Hopefully they had breakfast.
Yeah. Some of the things that are more interesting to them that aren't involved in that project in the classroom, right? Technology, peers, right? That emotional regulation, just to get over that, this looks like a massive project, or am I capable of this? What are some ways to not only acknowledge that, support it through our lesson planning and purposeful design with EF in mind, but also helping our kids to develop those personalized strategies? What's going to help you through this? When you're in a situation like this, in dance class, on the ball field, what do you do? How can we use that in the classroom?
So what about what about self-regulation challenges that comes directly from the frustration one might feel if they have dyslexia and have trouble, like, understanding what they're reading or getting, or maybe it's just taking a long time, or I can imagine there's lots of things about having dyslexia that would challenge your self-regulation. So how do you guys approach that in the classroom and in your the way that you work with kids?
Yeah, I think there's a strong connection there. I think for our kids with dyslexia, I think the biggest challenge for them is, despite that strong intellectual profile, bright kids, intelligent kids with dyslexia, oftentimes every task is looked at as a reading task. Mm. Right? A math word problem becomes a reading task.
Right.
So it's starting to think and work with them on, let's get beyond just the reading part and think about, if you're in that situation, what can we do? How can we support that, as Ben said? How can we make that more accessible? That content, we know you know everything under the sun about World War II, and you can make connections to modern day, but when we put an article in front of you, that's going to be a lot harder for you. What are some of those workarounds? How can we help you show what you know? And what are some of those ways that we can work through some of those executive functions? What's going to be the challenge? If you get disinhibited because that reading is so complex, how can we chunk that so we take a break in between, summarize that information? How can we set up the reading environment so you're not disinhibited? You know, what are some ways that we can help you stay focused on that? If that complexity or the size of that task is so overwhelming, you're dysregulated emotionally, what are some ways that we can either break this down once again or address that up front so that we have those strategies in place, using some planning and organizing skills potentially to say, great, now we can manage this task, right? The dyslexia makes the reading part harder, less efficient, right? It's the EF that's going to help them manage that difficulty.
So learning doesn't stop when school is over. How do you guys bridge the connection between home and school? Because there are also parents that may likely have executive function challenges right. themselves. Yeah. The apples usually don't fall That's very right. far from the tree. So how do you, what do you recommend for families, or what do you do for your families at Southport School? And also, what do you recommend for listeners whose kids don't go to Southport School to help bridge that homeschool connection?
Well, I think related to what Jeff just talked about, when we think globally about dyslexia or executive function deficit, what we really think about is the intersection of gene, brain, and environment. And at its core, we can't change our genes, at least not today. We can't change our brains, you know, not at the level to ameliorate something like dyslexia or ADHD. What can we change? The environment.
Yep.
And so all the things that Jeff just talked about, what we really need are children or adults to be able to do is to take healthy risks. And so we want to create environments where our kids can take healthy risks. How do you take healthy risks? You feel confident and you feel safe and you feel supported. And so part of what I think works so well at the Southport School is what Jeff articulated about setting up these frameworks during the day for really being able to allow students to identify those relative areas of strength, those relative areas of deficit, what are the tools they need or they can employ to be able to help sustain or self-regulate, and helping parents understand that we set those frameworks up. What do those frameworks look like? Even something like homework. One of the strategic aspects of our academic day is a study hall period. Now, it's not what you think about in a typical study hall where 20 kids go into a room and just do it whatever they want for 45 minutes. It's actually taught like a class so that students are learning those skills and how to employ them at home. And one of the biggest things we hear from parents is, wow, homework was always such a battle. And now my child is coming home and it's totally different.
That's really cool.
And so all we did was shift the framework, shift the structure to that, and provide that safe environment for them to take those healthy risks.
I love that you said that, because the whole time you were talking, Jeff, I was thinking, they're creating safety. That's what they are. They're creating safety.
For our kids.
I love it.
Yeah, for our kids, raising their hand to provide an answer in a class that could be a strength is a risk for them.
Yeah.
Because of their past experiences. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so, it, and once again, I think is what Ben was mentioning too, it's just changing the environment at home too. Because now that the students are taking that strategy when they're ready to take some of that work home, what are we asking of the parents? Not to play that teacher at home role, right? And we know that how challenging that is, right? Even as an educator, I know the struggle is real. My kids thought I was the worst teacher in the world. But all we ask them to do is provide that environment. Identify with your child when they're going to do their homework based on their schedules, their days. Set that time aside. Give them the right space. Make sure they have all the materials, things that they need. And if you want to be involved, have them invite you in. Mm-hmm. Oh, how do you do it? What's your routine? When they can explain that to other people, it's empowering, right? And then they own it. And it changes that dynamic where I'm not sitting there saying, okay, let me reteach you how to multiply fractions, but I'm going to show you the way I learned it 30 years ago.
That's right.
Because it's not the same one.
I love everything that you both just said. I've heard so many of, I mostly coach college students, and I've heard many of them say that they didn't really learn how to do things on their own until they got to college.
That's right.
And then it was really hard.
It's
and
too
it was
late
usually
in a way.
After,
right.
yes,
yeah.
it was usually after like a semester or two of like not doing that great. And like it showed in their grades, but it also really showed in how they feel about themselves, which is really sad to me, because then we have to work so much on building confidence and having
That's
them
right.
realize that, oh yeah, I actually can do this on my own.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's funny, my freshman year of college, one of the things I remember, because I did struggle in school, I was required to go to the library for 2 hours a day. And so I did it. I went to the library.
You were there.
Boy, did I make a lot of friends and annoy a lot of people. And so I would spend the 2 hours and then come out, and then I would feel this crash of shame, because I hadn't actually accomplished what I needed to get accomplished.
Oh.
And then it would eat at me. And it got to the point where I avoided going to class in the morning because I didn't want to have to confront the thing that I knew was like my biggest fear. You know, one tip for parents out there, I think we've seen a lot of times with our students, they've often felt so compared to, you know, other kids. And so when we think about the school day, it's all about, you know, they're going through this day of, you know, cortisol is spiked, their anxiety is spiked, and they're constantly comparing themselves to the other kids. And one success that I have seen is when outside of school, these students are able to find something not unique, but something that's maybe a little more rare, like an activity, like fencing is one thing I can think of. We had some kids over time who have like gotten into fencing, but something that's a little bit outside of the mainstream, because then they're in an activity where they're not feeling compared to like this broad group of people. And they actually help build their confidence because they're developing a skill at something that a lot of other people either have no experience with or maybe can't do.
Do you see, I mean, you must see changes in kids over the years as they move through the school and when they're ready to graduate.
Oh, it's transformational.
It must be transformational.
Oh my gosh. I think it's the best payoff that Jeff and I
best
experience.
Best part of the job. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, because I see that too. But it's just one-on-one. It must be so satisfying to see it in this like whole cohort
of kids.
Oh my gosh.
When you see, you know, I'll never forget my first year at the Southport School, because, you know, to see a student come in on the first day so tentative, not even making eye contact with you. And then to see them walk out the door with their head held high and with a skill set where they're going off to another school and their classmates are asking them, where did you learn to take those notes? Or how did you learn to do this? And they feel for the first time in their lives like they can be that leader. They have that sense of self and sense of confidence. I mean, it's truly transformational. And I think that's one of the reasons we have been so excited about this work with the Southport CoLab, because, you know, the analogy I use is if you've ever used those OXO kitchen tools, which are beautifully designed.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if you know why those exist.
I do.
So you know that story about
The person had arthritis.
Exactly,
right?
So they were developed for, I think it was a spouse who developed them for their spouse so that they could still do the work that they loved in the kitchen. And what we learned from that is those tools actually benefit all of us. And so much of what we know today about the science of reading, so much of what we know today about executive function, it all comes from decades of funded research from places like the National Institute of Health around students with dyslexia and ADHD and executive function deficits. And what we're seeing, the growth we see in the school that's transformational with our students, what we're seeing today is an environment where our kids generally are overloaded more than they have ever been.
Mm.
And so we're seeing large-scale executive function deficits in what we would call typical learners, right? And so the ability to take that transformational work and extend what we've learned that works and that we iterate every year to be able to benefit the general population is, I think, really one of the most exciting things on the horizon for us.
Yeah,
we have a division at Beyond Book Smart called Brain Tracks, where we teach teachers about executive function skills so that they can implement things into the classroom, not just for the students with ADHD, or just for the kids with executive function challenges, for everybody.
Yeah, we're looking at that as well. I think when we, once again, going back to where we started with the IDA, the new definition that follows the research on dyslexia, right? What it does open up to with that early identification piece is what we already know about years of research in structured literacy, which is it helps everyone.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
I think executive function, like where our position is, as we follow this research, we're going to hear as we get more and more that it's true about executive function too. Any work we can do with kids at any level, it's going to help every child at every age. And that's why at the CoLab, we do not only events for parents, but we work with preschool teachers and early ed teachers. Because the parents, right, we're that first teacher of our kids. And then oftentimes if we move our kids into some type of preschool program, they're next.
Yeah.
That's right.
Right? They're their first experience outside the home in a learning environment, in a social environment where their parents aren't part of it. So how are we going to help? How are we going to help them develop those right away so that they can function in a life skill and then into those academics? And I think that it's critically important to view both of those that way. And it is about training those adults, right? I always try to say that, yes, we are those first teachers, but also remember our kids, dyslexic kids, the ADHD kids, they're very perceptive. They're always watching.
That's right.
Yeah.
So we
that
need to
right.
role model it too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, we need as teachers and as parents to use that, you know, that monologue and just share your thinking. Oh, I need to really buckle down. I need to tune some things out here. Show them when you're using those executive functions, when something's challenging for you. How do you do that? They'll pick up on that.
Yeah, it's so true. Okay, so can we dive a little bit into the science of reading?
Sure.
Because I think it's really important for listeners to learn about this approach to reading instruction and why it works and why it's so important to learn about it and maybe even advocate for your kids about it.
That's right. So, you know, I think one of the most important things to understand about the science of reading is that the science of reading is really a body of research that helps us understand how we develop a reading brain. There's no one science of reading. There's no one settled science of reading. It's ongoing research that, again, really helps us understand how does the brain function? How does the brain uptake the skills needed to become that effective reading brain? And so really what the science of reading is all about is understanding how that research about how the brain makes those connections, how we can leverage that to make sure that we're doing instruction in a way that follows a scope and sequence that really allows our students to build those skills. And I'll give you one really kind of simple example. You mentioned earlier about this misperception that individuals with dyslexia flip letters. Well, there's a reason for that. Part of our brain, it's called the visual word form area, it's designed for object recognition. So when we're out scanning for food from an evolutionary perspective, we need to be able to figure out, you know, the profile of like an animal, or if we need to be able to locate, you know, a caregiver, our parent, we need to be able to map out if we've seen one side of their face that this is what we would expect the other side of the face to look like, right? So that part of our brain that's for object recognition, we co-opt that when we learn to read, because reading is not something we are wired to do. And so what we have, that visual word form area becomes that space where we are able to make that sound symbol connection. We're able to take those letters. And so that's actually why everybody, or almost everybody, typically flips letters around when they're learning to read, because we're co-opting something that was actually designed to do that. Now, it's true that individuals with dyslexia will typically do that with some more frequency early on, mm-hmm. but flipping letters in and of itself is not a sign of dyslexia. But it's understanding how the brain does work to build that circuit, that reading circuit, and using that to make sure that the instruction we're putting in front of them is effective. And this is one of the reasons why an approach like whole language has not worked, because it does not rely on building the building blocks of a reading brain. it's really been focused on just exposure to reading. And yes, that's important. We need to expose children to books, to the printed word. We need to model reading for them. We want them to enjoy literature. We want them to have a breadth and depth of experience with reading. But at the same time, they will never be an effective reader just through osmosis. So it's really using that science to build out the steps required to make everybody a strong reader.
Just in my own perspective with my own children, just, you know, not struggling with reading, but going through more of a balanced literacy program, which is really more of a, I think, instructional philosophy than research-based, right? It's more about, you know, we're trying to teach kids how to read the printed word and all those literacy skills. This is more reactive. It's more, what do you do when you can't read that word, right? And those inefficient strategies, look at the pictures, what happens when the pictures in the book disappear, right? What happens, you know, when you don't have that word in your lexicon, you're taking a guess based on the first few letters. And what does that do to orthography? What does that do to the formation, to that spelling? And it, to this day, we joke about my kids' spelling skills, but or lack thereof, it's real. Because they really don't have that command of that sound symbol code, and making a lot of those orthographic errors, even though they're competent readers, because it was just taught in that way of, okay, here's a little bit of phonics to kind of shore that up. If you're struggling with that, here's some sounds and things of that. It's not direct. It wasn't systematic. It's not following that sequence where it's building. So those rules that govern some of that printed language, they didn't assimilate.
That's right. Yeah. And what's interesting is dyslexia is universal. It exists in every single language. But there are some languages that are easier than others. There are some languages that are more what we call transparent versus languages that are opaque. So as an example, Finnish. Finnish is a highly transparent language. It's almost a one-to-one sound symbol relationship. Okay. So any of us can actually decode Finnish if we see a sign. Now, we don't know what that means, because actually, and that's probably the most important point, reading is understanding. So just because you can decode something doesn't mean you're actually reading. But in a language like English, where we have 26 letters that represent 44 sounds, we have what's called an opaque orthography. And so that's a really critical piece of this puzzle, is really helping unlock that opaque orthography, you know, for our students. And unfortunately, when we don't use the science of reading, early on, our children are mostly decoding words that are old English words.
Yeah,
so,
right.
Right, like a word like the,
yeah.
That's not a phonetic word. And so the words they're encountering early on don't actually pave the way for long-term success in reading. Because once they hit now third, but mm-hmm. always by yeah. fourth and fifth grade, most of the language they're encountering is highly based in Latin and Greek, yeah. multisyllabic words. They're more complex, and they're entering that space without the tools to be able to access that. And so what's ironic is, yes, we do have an opaque orthography, but once we get students into that third, fourth, fifth grade textbook language, the English language actually becomes highly statistical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of the words follow very specific patterns.
That's so interesting.
And actually, if we can teach those pieces, like one of the things we love to teach at the Southport School is morphology, which is understanding the parts of words and their meaning. So like D means down, right? So if you descend, you're going down, right? Or one of my favorite examples, if you decapitate somebody, cap means head, D means down, right? You're taking their head down.
Yeah.
If we can teach these pieces to students, they can actually accelerate and really, not just with decoding, but with vocabulary, with comprehension, right? All these different pieces. That's really what the science of reading is about, is understanding how our language functions and what are the requisite skills for our students to be successful readers in the long term.
And we think about it from a strengths-based approach. What are we doing? We're feeding our kids strengths. Our kids have that strong verbal comprehension ability. They have those fluid reasoning skills. Many of them have a pretty good vocabulary. So when you start to engage them in things like that, that morphology piece, that stuff that we all, or back in the day when I was in school, we signed up for Latin because we thought we'd learn the roots and all those things, do better on the SATs.
Yep.
That's what we're doing,
yep.
You know, and it's another entryway for our kids yeah. to have a better understanding of our language, because who are our dyslexic kids? They're those kids that are always asking, how, why does this work? Mm-hmm. And we're feeding that.
Why does it
mean that? And those are those connections that they can make when they can bring those strengths to that and not just memorization, which is not how we learn to read.
No.
Right?
Yeah.
It's, I can make a connection here and I could string these together and I know why, because I know those rules, I know those patterns, and that's going to set the stage for that that advanced reading work.
This is very validating because I've always thought of myself as like a word nerd, and my birthday is coming up, and for my birthday, we are doing a PowerPoint party, so you can like choose a topic and just do a brief, like a five-minute presentation on it, and so I'm going to do it on the Merriam-Webster Instagram account because they always have such interesting posts on like why words are like they are, and so that's that too right there is also the science of reading and also, mm-hmm. I guess, the history of it as well. But
and you know what's fascinating, you're absolutely right, and kids love that.
You
know, one of the most disturbing things about school generally is that when kids go into like preschool, they usually love it, right? I mean, kids are happy. We in a way kind of beat the love of learning out of our students, but you know, we're natural born learners. We want to learn, we crave that, and so you know, that ability to kind of dive in and discover things like that and really understand how things work, that's actually a relative strength for a lot of individuals with dyslexia or a lot of individuals with ADHD. Yeah. They love to figure out how things work.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so let's help them figure out how language works. And again, that helps everybody. Mm-hmm. Every student in the classroom benefits from an approach where they're figuring out how things work.
Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily think you could get excited about the words that you're reading. You think, oh, I'm just excited about the content. But hey, why not look at the words too? Very cool. Very cool. I recently, during the pandemic, I learned how to read Hangul, which is the Korean alphabet. And I think it is fairly transparent because there's just a few like exceptions to mm-hmm. the rules, mm-hmm. which is probably why I can read it. I don't know what it means.
Right.
Most of it, I don't know what it means, but I can read it. So it helps at restaurants. So. About it. But is there anything that you wish that like adults with dyslexia now would have heard when they were kids? Or like what super clear message do you want kids that are growing up with dyslexia now to hear, or parents that have kids with dyslexia? What do they really need to hear? The ultimate message.
I think one of the most important messages is that whether it's dyslexia or ADHD or an executive function deficit, these are not determinational pieces. They have nothing to do with intelligence. And we all need, everybody needs some level of accommodation in our lives. You know, we all have different strengths, whether it's, you know, on the sports field, whether it's academics, whether it's, you know, cooking. I mean, you know, we all know and we joke about things that we're either good or not good at. And unfortunately, everybody has to have the same experience in school. You know, we're all put in a place where everybody in that room has a different level of different strengths and weaknesses. And so I think we focus so much on reading, and reading is critical. But for individuals with dyslexia, that's a heavy lift and it's taxing. And so I think the most important thing I would want to say to somebody who's an adult with dyslexia is that, you know, that doesn't define who you are as a person. And there are a lot of things outside of reading that they are likely good at. And it's finding the vehicle or the access into the printed word in a way that's going to work for them, that's going to elevate, you know, their long-term success. And so if they can stop viewing that as a deficit or as a negative thing, I think that's a really powerful way to shift mindsets.
I love it. Absolutely. What about you, Jeff?
Yeah, I was going to say something similar. I do think their innate abilities of the dyslexic brain, and a lot of that too shaped by the environment. I admire their persistence, their determination. I do think too what's important for kids to know, but also adults to know, but also for children with ADHD is they do have a better understanding, I think, of themselves as learners over time. That what we need to do is really just teach you the way your brain learns best. That I think these poor children have that experience where they're feeling that, and these adults too have had that experience, probably shaped a lot of their self-esteem, that the way it's taught, I couldn't understand. So that's on me.
Yeah.
Right. And I think it's important to keep that messaging is, no, it's, we just need to teach you the way your brain learns best. Mm-hmm. And that's the conversation we have with even our youngest students when they come in, that we want to teach you. What we do here is try to teach you all your skills based on how your brain learns best.
Can we talk a little bit about the CoLab and how people can get involved and really benefit from that as well?
Absolutely. So we do a lot of work through the CoLab in public school systems, independent schools. We actually have done a massive project in one of the largest school districts in the country down in Maryland, where we have trained and coached teachers across 82 elementary schools in the district.
Wow, that's so cool.
So if people are interested in finding out more, they can look us up at the southportcolab.org. So it's southportcolab.org. And we offer a lot of opportunities for training and coaching. Coaching is really critical. And so we do that work in partnership, and we do it with all different size school systems, all different size communities, and all different types of communities. So we do a lot of work right here in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And again, we are actually all the way out in Alaska,
really
working
cool.
in communities that are serving large populations of the indigenous community. So there's a lot of work we can do, and are happy to share that.
Great.
And for teachers and parents too, some of those free resources, we have community lectures that you could find on the website. We do monthly reading screenings, free reading screenings at the school, using, as I mentioned earlier, a research-based literacy screener, where we could just give families things to think about, things to bring up with the school system to start a conversation or even allay some of their concerns. We do a monthly webinar for parents and teachers on executive function. Just a light, quick half an hour of bridging that gap between what we know about executive functions, what we know about our own executive functions, and how we can support our children's executive function development, whether we're their classroom teacher, a parent, or for both.
And if it's okay with you, I'll give a quick plug for our book, The Executive Function Blueprint, which is on Amazon. Jeff is the lead author. And what Jeff was really able to do was take a lot of these ideas we've talked about today around executive function and distill them in a way that is really easy to understand. Whether you're a teacher or a parent, it really breaks down what is executive function in a very simple and actionable way. And when we share that with teachers or parents, it's, you can almost see the light bulb go off.
That's awesome.
Above their head. And you know, it all leads back to what Jeff mentioned. It's all about engagement. The more we can have student engagement and learning, the better outcome we're going to have. And today, I would say across the board, the number one thing we hear when we talk to teachers in these large school systems or small school systems, they're struggling with student engagement. So the more pathways we can find to engagement, the more successful we are all going to be.
I love it. What a great message to end with.
Yeah.
All right. So listeners, check the show notes to find out more about the work that Ben and Jeff are doing and everybody at the Southport School and the CoLab. And thank you so much for joining me today. It was really nice to sit in person and talk. And it was also just really interesting and just lovely to have this conversation. So
thank you so much for having us. It was a real pleasure for us.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen. As this is my this is my penultimate episode of Focus Forward. I'm really grateful to have been able to close this chapter with a conversation like this one. It was so good. My main takeaways from talking with Ben and Jeff are these. First, dyslexia is not a lack of intelligence or effort. It is a difference in how the brain builds a reading network, and early identification and the right instruction can make an enormous difference, as we heard them say, not just academically, but emotionally as well. And second, dyslexia does not exist in isolation. Executive function skills, confidence, and self-advocacy all play a role. And when we support the whole learner, we give students a much better chance to thrive. You'll find resources related to today's conversation in the show notes. So if you want to learn more, be sure to check that out. And as always, this podcast is just one step on your journey and is not a substitute for educational, medical, or mental health advice. If you have any concerns about dyslexia, ADHD, or learning differences, I encourage you to reach out to a qualified professional for additional support. If you have thoughts about today's episode, I'd love to hear from you. You can email me at the podcast at podcast@beyondbooksmart.com, or you can look me up on LinkedIn or Instagram. And thank you, as always, for helping us spread the word about executive function skills. Your shares, reviews, and conversations really do make a difference. Thanks for listening.